prosperity in a time of great turmoil, with a people ruled by great emotion and uncontrollable urges, a leader would rise, a leader whose charisma was unmatchable, whose strength was incomparable, and whose mind was unfathomable. This leader would create a force that would bring all together, and that force would be called Twerpcast. Welcome to Twerpcast number 10, Wagcast. I would like to introduce you to that leader. But today I'll introduce you to Jim Caswell instead, executive producer and man in charge of Natural Methane Production.
Again, we go to the gas jokes. And I'm doomed to introduce Doug Zeitlin, CEO of Ewoks Unlimited, Endor's premier production company. They call him the Big Furry One.
They must have seen my butt.
No. If they had, they would have run screaming from the room, plucking their eyes from their sockets.
I'd also like to introduce you to our guest commentator, Matt Halloran, musician extraordinaire, and most likely to be contacted by aliens of the third kind.
So I had two introductions, but only one was used. So, what were you thinking? It's a writer's strike, and you wrote...
Well, when I get my union card and have to start paying my union dues, then I'll stop writing. No, I won't.
That actually, I think, brings up a very curious point. Even within the union rules, you must create two scripts that are sold before you can enter the union. So is this a workaround for the writer's strike? Can you actually take a bunch of nobodies and have them all write two scripts?
I don't know what the rules to get into the WGA were. I know that it seems sort of like a lot of guild membership things. Like for SAG, you have to actually say something on screen in order to get into SAG, but they don't want non-union people in it. It's the whole chicken and the egg argument with unions, and you have to do this first, but you only want union people to do it. My friend Kevin, when he was doing lighting out in California, he had the same kind of thing where he had to get on some jobs as a non-union person, and people had to take mercy on him before he could actually start doing it. But if they have that kind of rule with the WGA, I suppose that's an option that they could exploit, but since those new writers would want to be in the WGA and want the benefits of the WGA, I don't think that you're going to get a whole lot of people trying to scab their way into it, because that's essentially what they would be doing.
And once the strike was over and the regular writers came back, they'd be kind of messed over just because the new writers would resent them being scab workers.
And if they took the jobs of some of the regular workers, then they'd have even more animosity, like, hey, you took Frank's job. We don't want you around.
So, ladies and gentlemen, obviously, we're going to be talking about the writer's strike in this episode.
Hopefully, by the time this episode is on the air, the writer's strike will be over, but that is very doubtful at this point.
I guess the question that should be addressed first is, why is there a writer's strike? What is currently going on in Hollywood that has caused the writers to say, we've had enough, we're going on strike, here are our terms? What built up to this event?
Have either of you two seen the video, Why We Strike, on the internet? It's definitely worth watching. It's from the writer's perspective, so you have to take that grain of salt along with it. It does cover nicely what their issues are as far as the whole DVD residuals, new media, etc.
Of course we've seen that video.
Couldn't do an informed and well-thought-out show unless we research this material.
We do our research. We just often do research in different ways. And that's one of the nice things about bringing in a special correspondent, is that the research that you've done and the research that we've done can then get merged together to provide a better source of information for our dear, sweet listeners.
Of course. My research was a little bit more than going, huh, nothing new is on TV anymore. I wonder why. Oh, well.
Is that a potential that's going to happen? Can this writer's strike actually kill television? Baseball has yet to recover from a strike that's 15 years old now.
I've heard people talk about this sort of signaling the end of television as we know it. And that's one of the big points of the strike, is that things are going to the internet, and people are getting their entertainment off the internet. And that's why the writers realize that this is so very, very important to them, is that they don't want to get screwed over on the internet, because that's where everything is heading to. So TV has already changed, is changing. In a year, everything is going to be digital broadcast, so that obviously seems to point to things being digital over the internet as well. Movies sales are declining because people would rather watch things in their home, so you're going to get the Comcast On Demand stuff, that becomes more popular. So you already have this fusion, and so television is definitely gone, and with the writer's strike happening, and people not getting new content on their TV, that is going to accelerate it because more people are going to go to YouTube or whatever video sites that they go to get their entertainment.
If they desperately want to watch a television show, they can go and get their favorite television show on DVD and watch it anytime that they want to, rather than having to rely on when the networks put it on.
It goes without saying that really we're talking about legal downloads and legal copies of DVDs and things where writers will receive the royalties for.
Not anything that you can download off BitTorrent illegally or copies of DVDs or anything like that. We're talking about legitimate downloads.
I guess on the one hand, as a book lover myself, I don't mind seeing the end of television. But it's not the end of video entertainment at all. And it's clear that with the new media, that there has to be a new understanding of how things are going to be paid for.
I don't think that it's going to be the end of television. I think it may be the end of television as we've known it. I think that depending on how long the strike lasts, people are going to go and find other forms of entertainment, and they may decide that they don't need to come back once the writer's strike is over. At the same time, I don't think that the television studios are going to get stuck constantly showing repeats and things of that nature because they've built up a stable of shows that will last them for a little while, and plus they have the dreaded reality programming.
American Gladiators is making their return.
Woohoo!
All right. Why does anybody strike? Not just the Writers Guild. Why does any union go on strike? Effectively, it's a means of last resort of taking power away from those who are in a position of power. We had that Industrial Revolution in America where people were working 7 days a week, 18 hours a day. There was no control over employers. The workers had to do whatever they were told.
And the only leverage that they had was to stop the business that the business owners and those who had the power were counting on.
Effectively, that's what the Writers Guild is doing right now. People make their money on their programming. Writers are saying, you're getting no new programming. I guess we're in an interesting situation in Hollywood where we come from a period of time where back in the studio system, people wrote, they got paid to write, and they may or may not have received additional royalties for a rerun showing or an additional syndication showing, and that was it. Well, what is it the writers want?
The writers are simply wanting what they lost 20 years ago. 20 years ago, there was another writer's strike. It really was the dawn of the video age. VHS was a brand new product out on the market.
There was a competition between Beta and VHS, just like there's a competition between HD DVD and Blu-ray today.
And the writers wanted to make sure that they got the proper residuals for their work. The video that you discussed earlier gave a very good example of this. When an author writes a book, they get residuals for every copy that's sold. Musicians receive residuals on every record that's sold. But writers for the longest time were only getting paid once. They got a flat fee for the work that they did, and then that was it. Everything else went to the studios. In 1988, they were getting underpaid, and they had this new medium that they wanted to be able to get a residual for.
Earlier shows didn't get any residuals, and I know at some point the writers fought to start getting residuals for television shows. In order to get residuals from that point forward, they had to give up their rights to residuals from that point backward. Thus, the writers for I Love Lucy will never get any money for those shows, no matter how often they're replayed. So they want what they feel is fair. And the networks, of course, want what they think is fair, which is to get as much money for them and their stockholders and to minimize the amount of money that they can give to writers. And probably directors and actors as possible.
That's a good point. The networks in America have a fiduciary responsibility to their stockholders, not to their employees.
Did you just use the term fiduciary?
Yes.
Sounds like he works at a bank or something. Jeez.
That doesn't make them right. It just means that they're fighting for what they are responsible for.
People often call producers greedy, and I'm not necessarily going to argue with it, but their job is to be greedy, is to get the most bang for their buck, is to get as much as they can for it. And that's what makes them good producers, is that they can produce, they can get the monetary investment and get as much out of it as possible.
Now, what we're really talking about when we're talking about video sales right now, on an average $20 DVD, the writers are getting 4 cents. What they're asking for is an additional 4 cents. There's absolutely no reason at that rate of compensation that they cannot pass that on to the consumer. I'm sure every single person listening would be willing to pay $20.04 for a DVD rather than $20.
I believe that with DVDs, it costs more to shrink wrap the DVD than it does to pay the writers.
I think where the big area of contention is going to be is the quote-unquote new media, the downloading, the streaming. Because right now, writers are getting zero.
The producers would argue something different, because they would say, no, you got some money, but it was very, very minimal.
Here's another one of those differing points of view that we're going to be discussing probably a lot in this episode. The writers do get paid a lump sum at the very beginning. When they sit down and they sell a script, they do get paid for that script. The residuals are things above and beyond that initial sale. It includes repeats. It includes DVD sales. They want it to include any time that it's put out on the internet. I believe that where the studios are coming from is, no, you got something. You got that initial paycheck for that episode. You didn't produce it for free. And the writers are saying, yes, but we want those residuals on it as well.
I mean, the theory is that if the networks are going to continue to make money off of that product, then those who were involved in that product's creation should have the right to continue to make money off of it as well.
Now, in the situation with the internet, the rules do slightly change, because most places that deal with internet downloads of movies, it's either sold on an individualistic basis, in which case, yes, it would be very easy to track residuals, or it's a free download, which means that people can go to it anytime that they want, as many times as they want, to watch that episode. And the only money that the company makes off of those episodes are through advertising.
I think the producers would argue saying, well, we never pay the writers from advertising dollars. Since we're not making any money except the advertising dollars, the writers should not have any part of that because they never do. I was just sort of thinking that if the writers didn't take the pay cut in the 80s, they'd be making 60 cents per $20 DVD. They're making 4 cents instead of 60 cents because of a deal that they made 20 years ago. So that's not very much that they're asking for in comparison to what one could argue they should be getting. So we've got the DVD residuals that they want changed, but they also want to make sure that they get a fair deal on new media with the internet downloads. And the producers are wanting to say, well, you get 4 cents to every $20 on DVDs, so that's what it should be for the internet as well. That we should keep with the formula that's proven to work well for us for the past 20 years.
That's if they pay them for the internet. The production companies are also trying to claim,
we don't know where we're going to make money off of.
It's the same line that they fed them back in 1988 when it came to VHS.
That's what they're telling the writers, but if you look at programs of producers talking to stockholders, then they'll be saying, internet, new media, this is where things are going. This is where we're going to make a whole lot of money. They are either lying to their stockholders, which is a crime, or they're lying to the writers now.
What everybody knows is it is a new media. They don't know where it's going. If the real fear is they're not going to make money, and if they are lying to their stockholders, then they can come up with strategies in their contract, say a graduated system, where from 2008 to 2009 the pay will be this, from 2010 to 2012 it'll be this. They can say, we estimate these are what the sales are going to be, and when the next contract rolls around, you could see, well, they made more or they made less.
So what are the other issues on the table? Because these are the big two.
Those are kind of the breaking points right now. The third big issue on the table deals with reality programming and animation. right now the Writers Guild of America has no say over reality programming or writing for animation. They would like the people who work on those types of series to be members of the guild as well.
And, of course, the producers will argue with reality programming, saying, you know, most of what you see is real life. I mean, it's just happening. So writers aren't involved with that. But in reality, it's writers who are crafting the story out of that raw material.
My own sister was an editor for reality program. And one of her jobs was basically not to edit to what the people were doing, but to edit to what the writers and the focus groups found funny.
And with regard to the animation, that's kind of a sticking point within the WGA, because animation is covered with IATSE. In the old days, the animators were the ones telling the story. So they were essentially writing their own product. They didn't have separate writers. Now, the WGA argues, you have writers who write scripts and they send them to animators, and so that they're separate. So even though the people who are writing animated series are covered under IATSE, they're saying that really they should be covered with WGA. But IATSE obviously sees things differently. They have different priorities than the WGA.
This is a big political issue within unions themselves. When one union wants to take the employees for another union, they're talking big dollars. And there's genuine sticking points in transferring a set of workers from one union to another.
Especially in this day and age. Back in the 70s and 80s, the number of movies that came out that were animated, the number of cartoon shows that were on, were actually very minuscule. You had basically your Saturday morning cartoons and maybe your weekday afternoon cartoon block for an hour or two. It wasn't a large contingency. But in today's society, you have multiple companies that are doing animation projects. You don't just have Hanna-Barbera, Disney, and Warner Brothers. You have at least three times that number of animation studios out there now. You've got entire networks that are devoted to airing cartoons. You've got the Disney Channel. You've got Nickelodeon. You've got the Cartoon Network. All these shows have original animated programming on it. In this case, you're talking big bucks.
And frankly, with the advent of Flash, home animators really can do things on their computers that literally gets put on the air. Shows like South Park started, not with Flash, but started with Trey and Matt making their own cartoon. It became popular on the internet. But as we're going into new media, if people start doing their shows directly posted to the internet, they're thrown to the wolves. They don't have that initial lump sum payment. They don't have the residuals. They don't have new media pay. They'll basically get nothing.
So basically they're like us.
Or a lot of musicians out there.
Politics aside, I do agree with the WGA on this. I think that animation should be in the WGA.
These other issues, in some ways, they're the small potatoes of the strike. They're there, but if you ask the writers, they will say it's mostly about the internet and then it's about the DVDs. And the DVDs are very important to them because it represents the 20 years of a bad deal, but it's really about the internet. But these other issues do have an impact in where the state of the strike is, because the most recent thing that the producers did is give a list of demands, and in their demands were the things about the reality and animation, basically saying, take these off the table, you're not doing any of this, or we're not going to even talk to you.
Let's go through and discuss what the process has been and what has been done to try to reach some form of agreement.
The way I look at it is the producers have taken their ball and gone home. They said, you either play my game or you don't play at all.
I believe that the unions negotiate a contract every 3 years. And they've known that these were the big issues and that this was coming along. So a year ago, they knew that a strike could be coming because they knew that these were issues with the producers and that the producers weren't playing nicely.
One of the points that the production companies have been trying to make is that they feel as though if they reach this new deal with the writers, they are afraid that then the directors and the actors are going to come along and start asking for raises as well.
I say, so what? That's part of doing business. If you make candy, you know that the price of sugar is a volatile market. If the price goes up, you either pay that price and charge it off to the consumer, you don't pay the price and go out of business, or you buy a sugar plantation. You have certain costs of doing business. paying your writers, paying your directors, paying your actors. That's all part of the cost of doing this business.
I know that there are provisions in the contracts for the different guilds that say if the producers make a deal with one, then that set a precedent that the other ones would want to follow. I've heard it described as they're the point of the sword. And what they mean is that they're the first ones to deal with it, and what happens to them sets it up for everyone else, that this does affect the Directors Guild, this does affect the Screen Actors Guild. And that's why you've got the Screen Actors Guild supporting the WGA as much as they have, because whatever happens here with terms of internet and new media, it's going to follow suit. If the producers don't give it to one group, then it also sets a precedent to say, well, we're not giving it to them, we're not giving it to you, we're not giving it to anyone. I think that that's why the producers are being so stubborn about it, is that they don't want to set a precedent.
Again, that's part of the cost of business. It's not like television is making less money every year. Look at Super Bowl commercials. It's not like Super Bowl commercials went from $2 million a minute last year to $1 million a minute this year. Oh, no. Every year, Super Bowl commercials cost more and more. So networks are making more money every year. It's only fair that the people that are producing for them get that money every year also.
When you're talking about percentages, though, like the 2.5% that the writers currently get, when the amount of money made on commercials goes up, their percentage is naturally going to adapt to that. Their raw dollar amount will increase.
If it's $100 instead of $10, they'll get 10 times more money than they would before.
New media is a hot topic. If they start paying the writers for the stuff that goes on the internet, yes, they should pay the directors for what goes on the internet, and they should pay the actors for what goes on the internet. Right now, they pay no one for what goes on the internet. That is free money for the production companies.
It's free money that they don't want to give up. I think they looked at it and say, hey, we can take what we're making for TV, apply it here, and make some money, and it's just extra money. They got a new pie, and now the writers and the directors coming up and the actors are now saying, well, we want our cut of the pie.
Obviously, this is all very complicated, and it comes down to the bottom dollar. The question is what is the fair dollar amount as opposed to the unfair dollar amount? And that amount varies depending on which side you're standing on.
In this country, people are not going to side with the fat cat. They're going to side with the underdog. And yes, when we talk about the Directors Guild and the Screen Actors Guild, we are talking about a few people out there, the Steven Spielbergs, the Tom Hankses, and the Julia Roberts that are making a lot of money. What you're missing is that's not what the strike is about. The strike is about the guy who plays waiter number two, the guy who's directing his very first commercial for the low-budget furniture in town. Would you relate that to the writers? Television season's only 9 months long. That means every single writer is unemployed 3 months of the year. Their income is the royalties.
And that's just the television writers. Film writers literally live from movie to movie. They don't know when their next script is going to sell because they don't even have knowing that they're working on a television series.
The writers are wanting what's fair, and it's a question of what that dollar amount is. A bit of irony is that the producers have admitted that the writers are asking for their fair share. Going to the AMPTP.org site, there are a series of press releases from the producers, and there was one in early December that was very interesting.
An open letter to the entertainment industry from the AMPTP. The working writers themselves have now lost more than $115 million. And these writers are no closer today to getting their fair share of new media revenues than they were when the strike began.
In other words, the producers themselves are saying that the writers are no closer to getting their fair share of new media revenues. So the producers themselves have admitted that they're not giving the writers a fair share. I'm so surprised that the writers haven't jumped on that line. So let's get that timeline done and out of the way.
On October 31st of 07, the writers and the production companies came to the realization, we're not going to reach a negotiation here. There is one course of action left, and that's to go on a strike. So on November 5th, the strike actually began.
Both sides claimed that the other side walked out. And according to the writers, one of the things that the producer said is you wanting more money for DVD residuals. It's a deal breaker. And as long as that's on the table, we can't negotiate any further. Basically, one of those ultimatums. If you take this off the table, then we can talk. And sort of a last-ditch effort to not have get to the point of striking, the writers did say, okay, DVD residuals is off the table. And the producers still didn't give them anything for it.
They literally said, okay, now that that's off the table, we can't do anything for you as long as new media is on the table. You need to take that off the table as well.
Since they've known for a year that when negotiations came up that it would involve new media and that the producers weren't going to play nice and that it could lead to a strike, the good thing is that the writers have had time to prepare, save money, and that this period of unemployment would happen.
And they're not the only ones who were able to prepare for this strike to come. The production companies have known for a year that this is coming. They've been stockpiling scripts, they've been buying shows left and right, getting as much stuff produced ahead of time to be ready for the strike to hit. So it's not just a case of the writers sprung this on the production companies.
But the original thought was that the Writers Guild would go on strike in the summer, which is when the Screen Actors Guild negotiations happen. And the writers decided, no, we're going to strike now because they didn't want any more stockpiling. They didn't want the production companies to get more scripts and be able to bear down. So the production companies weren't expecting the strike to happen so soon. So it points to the WGA for applying leverage now as opposed to waiting.
And if they had gone on strike over the summer, the production companies could have sat there and went, okay, we weren't expecting anything to be produced over these 3 months anyway. We're not losing out on anything.
From what I've been able to glean, the stockpile will last through the new season. There's enough material to do all their mid-season replacements and have new programming in the spring season. Of course, we always go to reruns in the summer, but there's nothing new for 2008.
Again, my friend Kevin, who used to be in the industry, he was talking about when the pilots are done in the spring and the summer, those are going to get affected. That's why the strike, if it continues much longer, it could not only kill the rest of this season, but kill next season as well. And you've also got shows like Scrubs, where they got halfway through the season, and this is their final season. And the fans might not get the rest of the season, because they're not going to finish the season, and they're going to say, okay, the production's done.
Now, I have heard a release from Bill Lawrence, who is the producer of Scrubs, and he has said that no matter what, the fans of Scrubs will get the series finale, even if it means it going directly to DVD.
So the writers began their strike in November, and
right after Thanksgiving, the negotiations resumed, lasted until December 7th, at which point the production companies walked away from the table again.
I remember reading the blogs leading up to those negotiations, and there was a sense of optimism. They were sounding positive, and it was looking good, and then there were industry people like in Variety or something like that that were saying, yeah, we're waiting for the other shoe to drop, and basically thinking that it was a setup so that the producers could sucker punch the writers, which they did. So I believe what happened at those negotiations is that the producers said, here's our proposal. And it was something like they didn't say, here's a percentage. They said, here's a fixed amount, that you'll get X amount of dollars for new media stuff. And they said, this whole package is worth $130 million. And then the writer said, okay, well, that's not exactly what we were thinking, but we'll take a look at it. It doesn't add up to that, but at least they're showing some effort with it. This is what gave them hope and promise. And so the writers then came back and said, okay, here's our counterproposal. Instead of X amount of dollars for the online stuff, we want X plus Y dollars. At which point the producers turned around and said, I can't believe they're asking for X plus Y dollars. We don't even know if we're going to get X plus Y dollars, and they want to get that kind of money for it. They're being completely unreasonable. And they went to the WGA and said, look, you need to take this off the table. We can't even talk to you as long as reality shows are on the table. We can't talk to you as long as the animation thing is on the table. And the Writers Guild is like, hey, wait a second. You told us that we could only talk if DVD residual was off the table, and we took it off, and then you didn't talk to us. So we're not going to take this off the table because we don't believe you. And making demands isn't negotiating. Those are just ultimatums.
So where does that leave us The WGA is now looking at negotiating with individual companies rather than the AMPTP. They're hoping that by dealing with the individual production companies rather than this unified front, that maybe they can work a deal. Because right now, the big companies are okay. They've got their stockpiles. They've got the multi-millions of dollars that they can rest on.
They have revenue from other sources, such as NBC is owned by GE, so they have GE to fall back on. They can sell more toasters if they need to.
Universal has their theme parks, things of this nature. So they don't need to come to a quick resolution. They can kind of kick back and go, okay, we can wait you out. And so what they're hoping is that if they can deal with the companies on an individual basis, maybe they can strike some deals with the smaller companies and get some people back to work.
I think both sides are trying to apply as much divide and conquer as they can. And that particular battle is happening most on late-night television shows. There is an interim agreement between the WGA and Worldwide Pants, which is the David Letterman company, that says, okay, David Letterman, you can have writers, because Worldwide Pants has agreed to the WGA proposal, which is great on one hand. You know, some of the writers are going back to work, and it demonstrates that what the WGA is asking for is fair, and that applies pressure to the other production companies. So there's some division right there. It's bad because that means that some writers are working and some aren't, and those who aren't are going to be a little bit resentful of those who are.
I think ultimately it's good. What it is showing is where networks are really losing money. I mean, they have GEs and they have Viacoms that they can fall back upon, but ultimately television is supposed to generate revenue, and where they're not is late night. They are losing a lot of their audience, and they know the audience is very hard to bring back. They're losing a lot of money, and when companies like the Worldwide Pants make their negotiations and bring back the writers, they're putting strong pressure on the network itself and on the other networks to bring back original programming.
We're talking late-night television here. People might get the silly idea that, hey, maybe I could actually go to bed an hour earlier, and instead of getting 5 hours of sleep, I could get six.
Late-night TV is where people can get daily fresh content. Particularly, I'm thinking of the monologues, which comment on the day-to-day news. So Letterman is back, and he has writers, but so is Leno and O'Brien and the other ones. They've had to come back without their writers because they've got NBC and ABC saying, hey, you have a contract. You have obligations. You have this entire staff who's unemployed because you're not on the air. And they know if they don't create a show that their people are going to continue to suffer for it. So they've come back without the writers, and they speak of how much they support the writers, but by coming back, they're undermining the writers.
There are other unions in play here, technical unions, that these people should be walking off the set. They are just as much scabs as if they had writers on those shows.
And I think in the competition for late night, it's especially critical because Letterman and Leno have been competing for over a decade, and Leno has edged out Letterman. Well, if Letterman can get new content with writers, who are you going to watch? Are you going to watch the new stuff or are you going to watch the reruns? There's also another interesting aspect with this because the AMPTP is speaking for all the companies, but all the companies are in direct competition with each other. And some companies are going to be in stronger or better positions than others. The companies that are in a stronger position, they're going to be the hawks. They're going to be like, no, we can hold off longer. And the longer they hold off, their competitors are going to get weaker and their stocks are going to drop. And then they're going to have, oh, well, you're in trouble. Well, we'll buy you.
The production companies do have other things that they can fall back on, and they can actually participate in a little bit of a waiting game. The writers, if they aren't getting paid for their writing, they are unemployed. They have no income coming in. The production companies, yes, they might be making less money than they want to be or they could potentially make, but they aren't having to worry about, okay, in 3 months, I won't be able to feed my family.
Regardless of the parent companies and a network's ability to fall back on parent cash, they're still beholden to their own stockholders and their own board of directors. And when the stockholders start seeing their shares go down, they're going to be yelling at the board of directors, and the board can come in there and say, you know what, we don't want your no negotiation tactics anymore. You will negotiate.
some of the non-negotiation is they're just trying to play hardball, trying to screw over the writers as much as possible, trying to punish them for going on strike.
That's why you stop negotiations 3 weeks before Christmas and don't bother coming back to the table until after the new year. Let's give a little bit of a financial crunch to these people.
Yeah, they're trying to make it hurt as much as possible. I think there's incentive for them to continue the strike in the sense of if there are any projects that they don't want, if the strike goes on long enough, that gives them ample reason to say, okay. There are actual clauses that one of the provisions in there is saying if there's a strike that lasts for too long, they get their long strike, they say, well, you know what, we're going to have to just close this production and never reopen. We didn't want Journeyman anyway.
There are several series that either directly or indirectly have already suffered because of the writer's strike. Shows that were on the bubble, like Journeyman, like Bionic Woman, may not come back.
Journeyman has been de facto canceled. There was a date to order new episodes, and that date has passed. All the actors and the crew are free to do other projects now.
Not that there are any other projects going on, but even the strong shows, there would be a huge fan base, a lot of pressure once the strike is over for them to come back. But it's also very possible that at that point, people may have moved on. I suppose that's some advantage to the entire industry grinding to a halt, is that there's not a whole lot for people to go forward to.
Another example is that USA just canceled two of their shows. Whether or not it's directly because of the strike, we'll probably never know, but the 4400 and the Dead Zone were both canceled. The company just said, it's done, we're canceling it. The timing almost has to point to the fact that the writer's strike had something to do with it.
The bottom line still is that the production companies are there to make money, and the stockholders want them to make money. And so the guild strike is preventing that from happening. So I think it is hurting them, and hopefully it'll apply enough pressure to get them back to the table. And now that the holidays are over, hopefully that will encourage them. They've done their screw the writers over the holidays tactics.
I actually think that the production companies have enough alternatives to them that the stockholders aren't going to be as irritated as you're making out. They have things like reality television programming, which is cheaper to produce, very popular right now. They could potentially just fill the airwaves just with reality television, and a lot of the sheep out there just won't even notice that there's a difference.
I think there's a limit to the amount of American Idol spinoffs that they're going to be able to come up with.
In general, reality programming is a clear sign of the apocalypse, but the fact that they are bringing back American Gladiator, I think that's a very clear sign of the fall of civilization as we know it.
What about movies? We've talked about TV.
Fortunately for the film production companies, they do have a very heavy backlog of scripts that they have already purchased. A lot of the companies have planned out their film schedule all the way up through 2010. If things start really getting tight, 3 or 4 movies get released every single weekend. They could easily scale that back to 1 to 2 movies getting released per weekend, and those movies would have higher box office grosses because they're not all competing for the exact same dollar. The second that the production companies realize that, then the writers are in trouble.
Yes, there is a glut of movie scripts that have been purchased. When the A-list material is Alvin and the Chipmunks, what's going to happen to ticket sales when they get to the B-list material? Secondly, DVD sales have already destroyed the ticket sales market, and when you're down to B-list material, how many people are still going to be going to the movie theaters?
And the third point, I would say, is that people think of writers as just producing the script, but that doesn't mean that they're going to stay in final form. Because scripts have revisions and need changes and need adjustments, and they need writers to do those kind of things that they don't have. The new Star Trek movie, I believe they're going into production, but what happens when they need to add a scene? Who's going to write it?
Now, this isn't to say that the writers are completely not writing. There are a few rare circumstances where the WGA has granted waivers to special occasions. The Spirit Awards and the Screen Actors Guild Awards have both received waivers from the WGA, enabling writers to produce material for these award shows' use. On the other hand, the WGA has refused waivers for other award ceremonies like the Academy Awards.
Or the Golden Globes. things are going to get interesting with negotiations with the other guilds, because the Directors Guild negotiations are coming up. And it's interesting whether or not the AMPTP will negotiate with them and say, skip the writers, in which case, does that mean the writers are going to have to follow whatever the DAG gets or not? I know that the DAG has been supportive. I don't think they've been as supportive as SAG has been. And SAG's negotiations are this summer. So hopefully the unions will be united and not undermine each other.
Now, the AMPTP has come right out and said that they're prepared to write off the rest of this season and the beginning of the next season. They've already said, we're willing to wait this out.
And then they'll turn around and say it's all the writers' fault, because the writers are the ones who chose to go on strike. Part of what my interest in this is the rhetoric and the tactics. The AMPTP originally had one set of people doing their PR that were bad, and then they got rid of them and got in the so-called Masters of Disaster.
These are the people who planned out Bill Clinton's run for the presidency. They've done numerous presidential candidates, in fact. They are literally called the Masters of Disaster. That is the reputation that they have earned for themselves.
In looking at the tactics and trying to follow their website and their releases and how they spin things, a WGA member made a comment noticing how the entire industry in Los Angeles has been shut down and how many people it's affected, and they said, I look back and look at the havoc I've wrought. And so the AMPTP has grabbed that phrase and say, look, they were in it to destroy the economy and to create havoc.
As you said, this organization is known for their political campaigns, and political campaigns are smear tactics. That's all that this company is doing right now, is they're trying to smear the other one. And I think that this is going to backfire on them. When you have two presidential candidates going at each other, you have a headshot of them on the television every single day. When it comes to two organizations that are a little more esoteric, you don't know who the writers are. You don't know who the producers are. What you do know is NBC's on Channel 5. I know ABC's on Channel 7. When you get angry at somebody, are you going to get angry at the guy who didn't write the television show? Are you going to get mad at, boy, Channel 7 is really not showing anything that I'm willing to watch?
Some of the other tactics they've used is they'll say, well, an average writer makes more than a doctor. An average writer makes $200,000 a year. And that's because there are some writers who get paid a lot of money. But they're not talking about the median writer. They're not talking about what most writers make. They're using statistics to play the game to make it sound like, well, hey, writers make enough money. Why are they whining about wanting more money?
A writer on 24 is going to get a whole lot more money than a writer for New Amsterdam, which is a new show that hasn't even come out yet. You don't know if there's going to be DVD sales. You don't know if there's going to be repeat revenues. When you just compare those two sets of writers, the writer of 24 is going to be making heaps more money just because, yes, it will go to DVD, and yes, he may only get 4 cents on the $20 of it, but when you're talking selling millions of copies of that $20 DVD, that's still a good chunk of change. Whereas you have brand new writers, brand new shows that are just trying to get off the ground, they are making dirt money.
There's three types of lies. There's lies, there's damn lies, and there's statistics. It's the statistics above damn lies that the AMPTP are using right now. I'm a little more familiar with the Actors Guild, actually, in using statistics. We're all familiar with Tom Hanks. Easily gets $20 million a picture. He skews the figure for everybody else. At any one time, the Actors Guild, and I don't remember the exact numbers, but using a paraphrase numbers, at any one time in the Actors Guild, 90% of the people are unemployed. The vast majority, 51% or more of the Actors Guild members, earn less than $7,000 a year from acting. It is not their primary source of income. Now, if you were to look at an average income and you average out $20 million with the $5,000, all of a sudden actors make a lot of money.
Of course, actors do make a pretty good grande, low-fat, double mocha cappuccino.
There is a stereotype for a reason. The struggling actor who is also working as a waiter or waitress.
Your numbers are also going to get further skewed with writers because you have the hyphenates, the writer-producers, or the showrunners, the Joss Whedons. They aren't supposed to be writing, but they're still supposed to be producing. I don't know if their paychecks necessarily split between, okay, here's your writing pay, here's your production pay, or if they're saying, well, this is how much money they make and they're in the Writers Guild. It's just another way that the numbers can show whatever they want them to.
When I was taking journalism classes, I actually had to take a class on statistics. And this was the most miserable class for me in getting my journalism degree, specifically because there was one point where I walked up to my professor and I said, so basically what you're telling us is that with statistics, you can make them say whatever you want them to say. And he's like, now you've got it.
There's a joke where a bunch of accountants were sitting in a bar and Bill Gates walked in the room and they all started cheering, woohoo, and the bartender said, hey, what are you so happy about? And they said, the average income of people in this room just went up by $3 million.
When you say 4 out of 5 dentists prefer something, now you don't know what the pool size is. The pool size may have been 5 dentists. You don't know how the poll was conducted. It could be 4 dentists who were all paid to prefer it and one who wasn't. It could be 5 people named dentist.
It could be 5 people who, it's like, okay, which would you rather have, this toothpaste or baking soda? And they might say, well, I hate the taste of baking soda. And they can say, well, 4 out of 5 dentists prefer this toothpaste.
This is done mostly in politics, but there's push polling, where you force people to give you the answer that you're looking for. For instance, you might say, boy, did you know that Bill Clinton has had 5 affairs that have been proven? Did you know that he was caught cheating while he was at Harvard Law School? Did you know that Bill Clinton picks his nose? Would you approve of this? Of course not. And then all of a sudden the poll is, people don't approve of Bill Clinton.
What I can't understand is how their tactics can work, especially with the not coming to the negotiation table for over a month. Who's being difficult if one party isn't even showing up? I can't see how public opinion could ever go to the AMPTP with some of the things that they're doing.
I don't think a single person in this room has said that the AMPTP is playing above board. They have pulled out all the stops. They have played dirty pool pretty much from day one.
This is why they have to hire somebody like the Masters of Disaster, because right now public opinion is way against the AMPTP.
The monetary value of what the writers are asking for, the production companies have already lost that much. So there's a certain amount of, like, where is the fiscal responsibility for them to show to their stockholders? What are they going to say? I mean, I suppose they're saying, well, we're trying to protect the long-term interest, but if it goes another 2 months, well, there's another 2 years of what the writers asked for in increase. The logic kind of eludes me a little bit.
This isn't a logical situation. This isn't two giving organizations legitimately trying to reach a common good. Logic flew out the window well before October 31st. Now it's just a grudge match. The AMPTP doesn't care how much it's going to end up hurting in the long run. They want the WGA to knuckle under.
And you've got members of the WGA who are at this point saying, look, I can't take this anymore. You guys need to do something. Drop these other things. Just get to the bottom line.
So I can get back to work so I can keep on feeding my family.
And that's what the AMPTP wants, is that they want the WGA to get to their bottom line so that then they can negotiate even lower than that.
To go back historically, the last strike was during the Reagan era. And whether or not you like his politics, he is well known as a union buster. That's one of the things that he did. Where in another administration, very similar to his, although they're at this point not in the negotiations, we're coming up on a time period where to see who has the power. Is it going to be the unions or is it going to be the employers?
There is, of course, the governor could get involved, and the governor is a member of the Screen Actors Guild, I'm sure. And I'm sure he's getting heat because the southern part of his state is grinding to a halt.
So what are the production companies going to do? They can apply for additional waivers, but those are incredibly tough to negotiate. The WGA basically has to like the organization in the first place to bend a little bit and give them a waiver.
When it comes to something like the Golden Globes or the Academy Awards, where the networks show them and get revenue, then they say no.
The production companies, as we've said before, also has a backlog of material. But the problem with that is that it is finite supplies. And you have quality issues, like Doug pointed out earlier. Yeah, they might have 500 scripts sitting in the vault someplace, but they're all stuff that they didn't want to show the first time through.
And no one to polish them.
What the networks have is English-speaking countries across the sea. They can start showing British programming and Australian programming.
for the most part, the writers in other countries, and that includes Canada as well, have basically said, no, we're not going to cross this picket line.
But nevertheless, shows like Degrassi are still coming across. Shows like Doctor Who, Torchwood, I mean, these are produced over there. We're just purchasing them.
You could easily find Doctor Who not only airing on the Sci-Fi channel, but also being shown on NBC if things got tight.
There's the interim agreements, like the Worldwide Pants with David Letterman.
And United Artists.
I think that it would be good if there could be more of them.
That would put more people back to work and apply more pressure to the production companies.
As long as the union members understand and don't start getting mad and resentful towards those who get to work and those that don't. And if they do get angry, make sure that the anger is aimed at the right people.
Two other options that they have are doing what they did back in the 1980s, which was to recycle scripts and old shows to pick up the slack. Shows like Mission Impossible resurfaced in the 1980s because the production companies went back into the vaults, pulled out the old scripts, made a few changes here and there, and filmed quote-unquote new episodes with a new cast. In the case of Star Trek The Next Generation, they went into the vault, pulled scripts out from Star Trek Phase 2, and filmed them. Something that production studios didn't have back then are the dreaded reality series shows, which they can produce in nauseum because they don't have to worry about writers. At this point, I'm going to inform you that during the transfer stage, we actually lost part of the show that we had initially recorded. We're not quite sure if it's due to the recording gods saying, hey, you just went a little too long, or if it was because of Matt's magnetic personality. Either way, I'll give you this friendly piece of advice. Remember, kiddies, always make backups of your files. So I'm going to take it from here and inform you about the upcoming TORP projects we have. Matt is currently laboring away to put the final touches on Act 2, and we are hoping that he's going to have it out in a matter of days. His words, not mine. So we're going to cross our fingers and hope for the best. We also wanted to let you know that IMON 4 is still in post-production. We're not going to give a release date yet because we're not quite sure how long editing is going to take. We are, however, starting another new series called Derek Geist. We're in the process of doing casting, so if you are interested in joining our show, please feel free to go to our casting call page located off of our homepage and send in an audition. We will be taking applications to join this new series until January 27th, at which point we will be announcing the stars of our show. We would like to thank Matt for joining us today. If you would like more information about the Writers Guild strike, go to www.wga.org and www.amptp.org to get both sides of the story. Additionally, the video that we referenced can be found on YouTube. Search for WGA America, and it is one of their highlighted videos. The video is called Why We Fight. On behalf of Doug Zeitlin and myself, I'd like to thank you for joining us for TORPcast and remind you that feedback is always welcome. You can contact us by sending an email to jim@torponline.net. TORPcast has been a production of Timewheel Electronic Recording Productions, copyright 2008. Thanks for listening, everybody. TORPcast, out!